along the Corniche, overlooking the glittering waters of the Mediterranean, in which the streetlights and the stars are pleasingly reflected. Amidst such a scene, it's hard to imagine the violence this city has witnessed during the past 40 years, and my thoughts turn again to the reasons we've come here. While I've been researching Egypt and the hints of an ancient civilizing mission after a global cataclysm described in the Edfu texts, I've found something odd that seems to suggest a possible link between the megalithic monuments of the Giza Plateau and Lebanon. A few thousand years ago, Lebanon formed the northern sector of the land the Bible refers to as Canaan, which also included the region covered roughly by modern Israel, the Palestinian territories, western Jordan, and southwestern Syria. What interests me is that both in Israel and in Lebanon, there are mysterious megalithic structures on a scale that not only rival those of Giza, but seem to express the same underlying purpose to create something that would last. Sacred mounds, holy places that would withstand the test of time and that would continue to be venerated down the ages even if the religions and cultures associated with them changed. The Temple Mount in Jerusalem is one such place. Both Orthodox archaeology and biblical testimony put the construction of the first great edifices there back to the almost mythical time of King Solomon, that renowned magician amongst monarchs who supposedly ruled in the 10th century BC. The structure known as Solomon's Temple, the first temple of the Jews, was destroyed by the Babylonians in 587 BC and rebuilt by Zerubbabel in the 520s BC. A further ambitious restoration was undertaken by the Romanized Jewish monarch Herod the Great in the 1st century BC and completed around 20 BC. Some 90 years after his death, Herod's temple in its turn was destroyed by the Romans, along with much of the city of Jerusalem, in 70 AD. What survived was the immense trapezoidal platform known today as the Haram es-Sharif, where stands the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, the third and fourth most sacred places in Islam. We need not concern ourselves here with the recent history of this place, or how it came to be in Muslim hands, but the Dome of the Rock is so called because within it lies an enormous megalith known to the Jews as the Shatiya, literally the foundation. When the Temple of Solomon was erected over this exact spot in the 10th century BC, the Shatiya formed the floor of the Holy of Holies, and the Ark of the Covenant, that enigmatic object which I have investigated extensively in another book, stood upon it. The Shatiya is not the only megalith in Jerusalem that dates back, potentially, to what the Edfu texts would call the time of the gods. Of course, this huge natural rock has been in this place, at the summit of a primeval mound, rather similar to the natural hill now enclosed within the Great Pyramid of Giza, for an incalculable period. But at some point, perhaps at the date in the 10th century BC that archaeologists accept for Solomon's temple, perhaps later, perhaps much earlier, it was modified by human beings, and there is now a hole cut through it which sheds a beam of light into the natural cave, also modified by human hands and evocatively known as the Well of Souls, that lies directly beneath it. I've been in the Well of Souls several times. If it doesn't have the raw atmospheric power of the subterranean chamber beneath the Great Pyramid, it's only because local bad taste has allowed the well to be tiled, carpeted, furnished, and lit as a prayer room. But the way the great rock that covers it has been cut and shaped is highly reminiscent of patterns that are found on rock-hewn surfaces at Giza. My guess, in short, as at Giza with its underground chamber beneath a natural hill, is that the rock and the well formed the original sacred shrine around which everything else on Jerusalem's Temple Mount was built. What came next was a platform, solidly founded, of gigantic stones to create the level, elevated surface upon which all later temples and mosques would be built. It is not my intention to explore the mysteries of Jerusalem here, but before moving on to Baalbek, the main focus of the present chapter, I will simply register surprise that the huge megalithic blocks which have been discovered in the so-called Hasmonean Tunnel, lying to the north of and directly extending the famous Wailing Wall, blocks weighing in some cases more than 500 tons, have been so readily assumed to be Herod's work. In the same way, the very similar gigantic megalithic blocks of Baalbek are assumed to be of relatively recent date, spanning the late 1st century BC to the second half of the 1st century AD, and to be the work of the Romans, with perhaps some early contribution by Herod himself. But just as the history of the Giza Plateau has been forced between narrow and restricting bounds, so too with Baalbek. Parts of it may be much older than presently believed. What led me to consider this possibility at all, indeed the entire reason I'm in Beirut in July 2014 and about to take a run over to the Bekaa Valley, Hezbollah, and the Syrian border, is the weird connection that I found linking Giza with ancient Canaan and with the ancient Semitic people known in the Bible as the Canaanites. The Magician Among the Gods. Selim Hassan, 1887 to 1961, was what a real Egyptologist should be. Passionate, erudite, deeply versed in his subject, and open-minded. He was also a hands-on excavator, and in the 1930s carried out the most thorough and detailed investigation of just about every major structure on the Giza Plateau. In the process, while excavating the Sphinx enclosure, he came across evidence of a Canaanite presence at Giza, indeed a long-term Canaanite settlement, which for some reason had been particularly focused on the Sphinx and its megalithic temples. How these people came to settle in Egypt, and why and when they left, we have not as yet any written inscription to tell us, Hassan admits. That they were there from at least the 18th dynasty, 1543 BC to 1292 BC, is well attested, but the possibility cannot be ruled out that their stay in Egypt dates back long before that time. At any rate, numerous votive stelae and other marks of respect to the Great Sphinx of Giza, inscribed and offered by members of this Canaanite community, have been found. We've seen already that the Sphinx was identified with the Egyptian god Horus, who could appear in many forms, but most often as a falcon. Of interest, then, is the fact that the Sphinx, in the Canaanite inscriptions, is called Hurna, and sometimes Horon. These are not Egyptian words at all, but instead are the names of a Canaanite falcon deity. The reader will also recall from chapter 10 that the ancient Egyptians often called the Sphinx Horem Achet, Horus in the horizon. It turns out that this name is directly linked with Hurna in a number of inscriptions not only left by members of the Canaanite community that had settled near Giza, but also by the ancient Egyptians themselves. For example, a plaque of Amenhotep II where the pharaoh is referred to as beloved of Hurna, Horem Achet. Selim Hassan comments on the assimilation of the names Hurna and Horem Achet in Amenhotep's plaque, which succinctly confirms the use of the name of the god Hurna in Egypt and its association with Horem Achet and application to the Sphinx. Likewise, a stela found at Giza reads, "Adoration to Horem Achet in his name Hurna. Thou art the only one who will exist till eternity, while all people die." And a second Giza stela represents Hurna in the form of a falcon, beside an inscription which reads, "O Hurna, Horem Achet, may he give favor and love." Christiane Zivikosh, director of religious studies at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, adds that the variant Horon was also frequently used in the same way. Horon was so closely associated with Horem Achet, name of the Great Sphinx of Giza, that one addressed him indifferently as Horem Achet, Horon, or Horon Horem Achet. What really caught my attention, however, and put me on the plane to Beirut, was a further observation from Zivi Kosh. An epithet on a Sphinx statuette, she reported, indicates that Horon is originally from Lebanon. Intriguing, too, in light of the civilizing work of sages and magicians of which there are so many traces in the Edfu texts and in the Mesopotamian inscriptions, is a baked clay tablet from the ancient city of Ugarit on the Mediterranean coast of what is now Syria, a little to the north of Byblos in Lebanon. Horon is the subject of the tablet, and exactly like the Apkallu sages of Mesopotamia, he is portrayed as a conjurer. Indeed, notes Egyptologist Jacobus van Dyck, as the magician amongst the gods. With further echoes of the Apkallu, Horon's magic consists of what sounds to the modern ear like advanced scientific knowledge, in this case providing antivenom extracted from among the shrubs of the Tree of Death that cured the victim of a deadly snake bite. The poison was neutralized, we read, so that it became weak and flowed away like a stream. And there is something else, something that points directly towards Baalbek with its mysterious megaliths. For not only was Horon, Hurna, worshipped at Giza and assimilated to the Sphinx and to the falcon Horus, but Baal, the Canaanite deity after whom Baalbek is named, also had a cult in Egypt where he was associated with Set, the god of deserts and storms. Last but not least, there is the fact that Baalbek was renamed Heliopolis, Greek for City of the Sun, after Alexander the Great conquered the Levant and Syria in 332 BC. The reader will recall from chapter 11 that Innu, the sacred city of the ancient Egyptians where stood the Temple of the Phoenix, attended by the priesthood of Giza, was also called Heliopolis by the Greeks. They referred to it as such from at least the time of Herodotus in the 5th century BC, and the Romans followed suit. Likewise, Baalbek continued to be called Heliopolis throughout Roman times. Marching in Alexander's footsteps, Pompey annexed the Levant and Syria in 64 BC, and Roman power here reached its height in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, when a statue of Jupiter, the most high and the most great of Heliopolis, stood in the courtyard of the great temple that the Romans built at Baalbek in honor of this god. As well as its usual Roman attributes, the statue, which may be seen today in the Louvre Museum in Paris, displays a winged sun disk on its chest. A possible reference, argues Friedrich Roget, formerly professor of architecture at the American University of Beirut, to the god of Egyptian Heliopolis. It was not until the Arab conquest in the 7th century AD that the original Canaanite name Baalbek began to reappear in Levantine annals, and it was only then that the city's Greco-Roman designation as Heliopolis fell entirely out of use. Between Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon Ranges. The morning after our late-night arrival in Beirut, Lebanese friends kindly join us at our hotel to drive us to Baalbek. Over coffee before we go, they tell us of our good fortune. There is a lull in the fighting in Syria. All is calm along the border, and they expect no trouble. Seen in daylight, the Lebanese capital is almost as charming and beautiful as it was at midnight. 120,000 people were killed in this country during the terrible and protracted civil war between 1975 and 1990. But the city, which was the focus of so much of the fighting, seems to have put that ghastly episode behind it. Most of the bullet holes, shrapnel and blast wounds in the buildings have been repaired. There's a lot of new construction going on, and the atmosphere is one of optimism and vigorous enterprise. Yes, there is sadness in the air. It's unavoidable after so much murder and mayhem. But the sense I get is of a nation recovering from its trauma, not wallowing in it, filled with bright, intelligent young people who are determined to move ahead. The traffic is heavy as we wind our way up the steep foothills of the Lebanon Mountains to the east of the capital. It's only 86 kilometers, about 53 miles, to Baalbek, but there are frequent military checkpoints where we're filtered through chicanes and inspected by attentive, heavily armed soldiers. Inevitably, this slows us down. The views, however, get more and more spectacular, with the Mediterranean gleaming behind us and the great green tree-strewn ridges of the Lebanon Range rising ahead of us. The road wraps itself around multiple tight hairpin bends above vertiginous drops. The air becomes notably cooler and the landscape more barren. Then we're over the top, through the Dahar al-Bedar Pass at an altitude of 1,556 meters, 5,100 feet, and motoring down the other side with the broad, intensively cultivated sweep of the Bekaa Valley opening out below us. We pass the edge of the urban sprawl of Zahle, famous for its Ksara winery, and pretty soon we're running through the Bekaa proper, although it is really a plateau rather than a valley, since its average elevation is more than 1,000 meters, 3,280 feet, above sea level. Bounded on the west by the Lebanon Mountains over which we've just driven, and on the east by the Anti-Lebanon Range, the Bekaa is watered by two historic rivers, the Litani and the Orontes. When the Romans colonized the region 2,000 years ago, this fertile plateau was one of their breadbaskets, exporting grain to feed the empire. Today, a more lucrative crop, though largely hidden from view, is cannabis. In the interests of keeping local farmers happy, the authorities generally turn a blind eye. After another 30 or 40 minutes of mainly level driving on a long, straight stretch of road with cultivated fields on either side, we enter the outskirts of Baalbek, at the edge of the Anti-Lebanon foothills. It's a shabby town of shops, offices, and dilapidated low-rise apartment blocks, many festooned with the Hezbollah flag, featuring an upraised arm at the end of which is a hand clenched into a fist around an AK-47 assault rifle. Hand, arm, and Kalashnikov emerge from a line of calligraphy spelling out Hezbollah's name, Party of God. Other lettering states, "Then surely the Party of Allah are they that shall be triumphant," and separately, "The Islamic Resistance in Lebanon." The background color of the flags is a strident yellow, while the logo and calligraphy are picked out in green. Fashions and preferences in gods come and go, but the sacred landscape endures. On an eminence above the town, we can clearly see the spectacular remains, the soaring columns, and the lofty pediments of the group of three Roman temples that bestowed such renown upon Baalbek in the ancient world. Dedicated, supposedly, to Jupiter, Bacchus, and Venus, they were built on a scale larger and more imposing than almost any other Roman structures, including those in Rome itself. What really interests me, however, is the megalithic wall that surrounds the Temple of Jupiter on three sides, and in particular the three gigantic blocks known as the Trilithon that are embedded in it. Much that I've learnt about the Trilithon in my prior research has led me to suspect that it may be older, far older, and dedicated to a far more enigmatic purpose than anything the Romans built here. Now's my chance to find out. Centuries of darkness. The mid-morning sun is beating down out of an absolutely cloudless, clear blue sky, and I'm sitting on a big limestone block, roughly in the middle of what was once the Temple of Jupiter. I say once because there's very little of this towering edifice left standing now, other than the six immense columns that rear skywards about the width of a football field behind me. The last six, out of the total of 54, that originally demarcated the exterior of the vast rectangular structure. The site is so enormous, the complex of temples so colossal, and at the same time so ruined, that I'm finding it difficult to get my bearings. Also, I have to confess, the long echoing booms of distant artillery, punctuated by the rapid stuttering coughs of heavy machine guns, and an occasional very loud explosion are a little disconcerting. Okay, I think, deliberately shutting my ears to the sounds that are, almost certainly, only the Lebanese military doing some practice firing, let's figure out what we've got here. I glance over my shoulder, and when I do, I'm looking roughly southeast, through the six big columns which stand on the edge of the massive platform I'm in the midst of, across a sunken plaza, to the row of a dozen columns that line the northern perimeter of the smaller, but more intact and still very beautiful.